Hello and welcome back to Cooking the Books with me, Jilly Smith, the podcast which takes us through four food moments from the books of our favourite food writers. It's about all of life through the prism of food. And this week I'm with award-winning writer Angela Clutton to talk about seasoning.
Feeling the arc of the seasons, it is sort of what this food means to me. It is connecting with how you feel about yourself, how you feel about the way you want to eat, how you feel about the arc of the year.
This is so much more than a bit of salt and pepper on your food. This is about how climate is changing our seasons, with its earlier springs, longer summers, warmer, wetter winters, and the role that we can play in the food system. It's a book packed with the rigour we associate with Angela's writing, but brimming with flavour and delicious ideas to reduce our waste and get more, much, much more out of the here and now. It has all the hallmarks of a modern classic, and in publication week, I asked her how she was feeling.
It's always a strange time, to be honest, because you work for so long on a book and you're on your own for most of that. And then you have the gorgeousness of being with the team, putting it together. So that's, you know, the designer and the publisher, even before you get to the studio, with the photographer and stylist and all of that. And that's gorgeous. And then there's this lag when it's, you know, obviously pages being printed and being sent to bookshops. And so when this bit wheels round, it's a little bit surreal. I think I'm finding it a little bit. So this is my third. I think I'm finding it ever so slightly less surreal than with the other two, but it's exciting. It's madly, madly nerve-wracking because I love it. And, you know, you just want everyone else to love it.
I've followed your journey. You know, I've just been listening back to an interview that we did. I think it was just after The Vinegar Cupboard came out. But I was also there to witness your win for the 2018 Jane Grigson Trust Awards. And we're coming up to Jane Grigson time again. And I'm looking at the contenders now. And it's, you know, back then you were talking about that process. You were talking about, you know, giving birth.
I don't have kids, Jilly. Maybe that's it. My books are my kids. Maybe that's
you did actually say that. I haven't got kids. I've no idea what it's really like, but it feels like that. But the point is that there's this big pregnancy. There's this gestational period. And that's what you're talking about. And that's where a lot of the creativity comes from. And then there's a birth. And it's out there. And yeah, you do nurture a child, but you don't necessarily nurture a book. It is up to everyone else now to do what they will with it. Going back to The Vinegar Cupboard, for example, and that, you know, first experience of gestation, compare that with what happened to the book. What was the process that you can take into seasoning?
Well, you do your first. You don't really know which way is up. And so I remain phenomenally grateful to Jane Grigson Trust. I was only talking with John Sloan actually last week and saying, I really do think if I hadn't won that award at that very critical point in doing The Vinegar Cupboard, I was still very, very early days of writing it when I won. That's the amazing thing about the Jane Grigson. It's to help people on their way before the book's even out there. And I am not sure I would have gone on to have had any kind of food writing career if I hadn't won it. And I mean that very, very sincerely. And so the more you do, obviously, the more confident you get about doing it and the more certain you are about the direction you want your work to be in. I mean, certainly for seasoning, I felt very, very strongly about the book I wanted to make. And I was quite determined to only make it with a publisher who got it, who really, really wanted to make the same book with me. Because, you know, you've seen it. It's a big book. It's, you know, there's a lot in there. There's a lot that we're trying to achieve. And I obviously, you know, we all make compromises, and creative compromises are part of the process. And yeah, you know, I'm not arrogant enough to not think that that is part of the deal. But I really wanted someone who would go on that journey with me. And I was then beyond thrilled, and remained beyond thrilled, that Murdoch, Celine Hughes in particular, really, really got it and have made this book with me. And I think you only get that confidence maybe from being older, actually, but also, you know, from having done the other two and think, okay, this is the book that I've been building up to. I want to make it the best I can make it.
Yeah, I think it's about setting you on the tracks, giving you the validation, the belief that you can do this, and then putting you on the tracks and encouraging you and allowing you and enabling you. And I think that that's a really interesting track. You know, I do a lot of food writing retreats here, and we talk about how you get to say what you want to say, to whom and why. You feel like you have a much clearer sense of what you want to say. I think that, you know, with the vinegar cupboard, it was definitely how you want to say. You know, you've got a particular style, which is about rigour, and you deep dive into, you know, history and story. But it is about rigour, and that would be your sort of byline. Angela Clutton, the rigorous writer.
That's not very glamorous, Julie, to be honest.
But we don't necessarily need glamour, actually. We need depth and heft. And, you know, that's what makes a modern classic. You know, all the Instagrammy stuff can be the glamour, and that's very passing and temporary. You're not a temporary kind of writer, I don't think.
No, I'm teasing. I do appreciate that. I do like to think that my work is pretty comprehensive, and that is what I wanted to do with Seasoning. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Your vinegar cupboard, it is, you know, a very, very, very deep dive into vinegars around the world. It's a very particular kind of thing. My second book, Borough Market, The Knowledge, was very much a collaboration with the market, and a joyous one, and a gorgeous kind of coming together of my years working with them, but a very different kind of book possibly for me. And so I felt with Seasoning that I really kind of wanted to get back maybe to that rigor, to being comprehensive, to doing something which was going to be a Bible, you know, a real kitchen companion for people. That's at its heart, that's, you know, that was in the first line in my proposal. It what I want it to feel is a kitchen companion that people can keep on going back to again and again and again. And to achieve that, I think there does have to be a certain level of rigour to it.
Yeah. And what's so interesting about it is that it probably will be a modern classic. It has the look of it, beautiful Patricia Niven photography, which I do want on my wall. I might have to ask you to connect me with her, because I think I want her prints all over my house. Absolutely beautiful. But it is called Seasoning, and it is about seasons. And we are at a very critical time in food, looking at the whole of the food system, but particularly at a time of climate change. You have taken that on, not in a heavy-handed way. You use the word sustainability a lot. But what do you want to say to whom and why about climate change?
I really appreciate you picking it up like that, Gilly, because I didn't want to make it feel like an issues book. I wanted it to be a cookbook, and I wanted it to be a cookbook that was filled with joy. And the joy comes from embracing the seasons. But there is a really kind of serious thing behind that as well. There's a feature at the beginning of the book, which is about our shifting seasons and how, you know, things we can all feel it, you know, that springs are coming that little bit earlier than they used to. And summers are obviously going on that bit longer. And it's all it is changing. And how we get our food, where our food comes from, where it's produced, where it's grown, does have a considerable impact upon that. When you're getting things or seeking out things out of their natural season, the only way they're being grown and reaching us is by being artificially kind of produced with light and heat and storage, let alone before you even start to think about all the transportation. And that's all just extra, extra, extra energy. You know, I have a quote in the book about, you know, the produce with the lowest greenhouse gas emissions is very simply what's grown in season and locally. And when you think about it like that, it's like this dead simple. It's nothing hard, nothing hard about it, except maybe the hard bit is really kind of being comfortable and excited and perpetually inspired by what's around in its season. And that's the answer I'm trying to give. So it's in no sense a finger wag at anybody. It's just hopefully a resource to just really embrace the seasons, because it does matter.
It really does. And it's not one of those books that, you know, 15 ways with the chard. I know you hate chard, and actually you don't hate chard anymore. Thank you.
I have to
thank you for spending so much time with chard. I love chard, and I love growing chard. But and we'll talk a little bit about chard later. But this is probably a book for your middle class, middle England, who loves to cook, who's already probably quite a good cook. And you can, you know, cut through the how to and go straight through to the why to. So there's lots of tips about how to flavour pear. And we'll talk about that in one of your food moments in a minute. But it's very important. It's about how to get the best of British food. It's a you know, unpacking of all the amazing foods that we actually have at our disposal, even through the hungry gap, which must have come through from your time at Borough Market. I mean, you still work very much with Borough Market, but you know, that last book that you wrote was deeply in conversation with the growers, the producers, the greengrocers. What stories were you getting from the front line of those people that you've brought to the book?
I think even more than the stories from the traders specifically, it was a feeling that, you know, I'd be down at the market a lot very early in the morning to get those stories from the traders, to hang out with them. And what I would feel sort of deep in my soul probably is that the arc of the year and how that affected what was appearing on the stalls and the mood and the flavours and the colours and the smells and the sounds. And that really, really connected with me so strongly, as well, obviously, as thinking, OK, so this is where I'm going to get, you know, this, that and the other at different times of year. It was more of an emotional feeling that has stayed with me. And I think that's the story I wanted to tell of how you can sort of soulfully connect with the seasons in your kitchen.
I just wanted to mention King Charles. Not that you have a particular connection with him, but you do talk about Hoggett. And while I was reading your bit about Hoggett, I was thinking, actually, King Charles, when he was Prince Charles, was talking about this in the early 2000s. He was saying, you know, we really need to be thinking about the meat that we buy and why we buy it in a particularly sustainable way. I think that that's what food writing is about. It's about thought leading. Tell me briefly about Hoggett, why we don't see it in the supermarkets and what you would like to see, and perhaps, you know, bringing together some of the ideas from Borough Market.
For me, it's about understanding what it is that we're buying and what it is we put on our plate. A lot of the time when we're buying lamb, it's a word for sheep, really, because we could be buying probably not mutton. I think we would know if it's mutton, but you probably are actually buying Hoggett, which is just, you know, an older sheep than a lamb is. But the word lamb has become what everyone is so used to and what's so comfortable with. And people don't really understand that a Hoggett is even more delicious because it is that bit older. It's had longer on the pasture. Its muscles and fat have developed, and therefore your flavour has developed too. And so I think it's about understanding what it is that we're buying, because that's how you support your farmers and your producers. And that really, really matters. We all just need to know just ever so slightly more. Does it matter whether you go into a butcher's and ask for lamb or Hoggett? Maybe not, but maybe yes. Maybe that helps those farmers have a herd which is more sustaining and therefore sustainable.
Yeah. And, you know, I notice we'll go into your four food moments now, and your first is roast chicken. And so many people will say to me on this show now that roast chicken is still their favourite dish. It feels very much like a, you know, a British classic, but they will say they'll have it maybe once a month. It will be organic. It will certainly be free range. The issues around how chickens are grown is hugely important. Now, that's changed phenomenally. Is that one of the reasons why you chose this as your first food moment?
Do you know, it's probably not, to be honest. I do have a section in the book about spring chicken. I was sort of quite amused and intrigued by the notion of spring chicken, and, you know, that phrase for, you know, thinking about something as kind of young and sprightly, and we have such issues now with the ages of our chicken that they are fattened up so fast, they're not even old enough to make, you know, to be feathered and make it out into the air. They're just kind of, it's just wait, end up in the supermarket. And so it's so the whole notion of rearing chicken and then the age of it's been very much turned on its head. So I do talk about that in the book, and it was very important for me to talk about that in the book. And I'm very, very supportive of places like Piper's Farm, who are being very kind of, you know, aware and open about what they're doing with rearing their chickens. But the reason for choosing chicken, roast chicken, for my food moment was much more sort of simply joyous than that, to be honest, because it is exactly as you say. I'm sure loads of people say it. You know, roast chicken is kind of the ultimate comfort food. We had it last night. It's just such a lovely, lovely thing to have. And especially, you know, if you are able to make the choice to do it in a way where the chicken is of a certain kind and, you know, sustainable and all the rest of it, and also then going to taste all the better for that. But for me, it's that the smell of it, you know, the taste of it, obviously, but also the roast chicken, I feel very connected with the arc of the seasons and the arc of the year and the way that we do it. The recipe that we have in the book is for the roast chicken with asparagus and purple sprouting broccoli, so spring, early spring vegetables. And what I do with the chicken is I cover it with lots of oil and salt and fino sherry, which is, I think, is a thing that makes chicken skin just like absolutely sensational. So all of that becomes the cooking juices. And then when you take the chicken out to rest it, you've got all this gorgeousness in the bottom of the tin. And I don't really tend to make it into gravy. What I do is use it to cook the vegetables. So then I toss the asparagus and the purple sprouting broccoli in with the chicken juices. So they take on the chicken flavour, the olive oil, the fino, the salt, all the rest of it, and all the herbs and things that have been stuffed inside the bird too. And it's a, it creates gorgeous through line of flavour because those juices are, you know, umami laden gold, really. And so I love that recipe in the book because I do that a lot and it's absolutely divine. But I love it also because that core idea runs right through the year. And so I just switch up what I toss into those juices depending on what's in season. So in the summer it would be peppers or courgettes, or, you know, take the juices out into a pan and do, you know, broad beans or something with them. In the autumn I do it with, you know, fennel, maybe even some chunks of fig, some leeks. In winter you do it lots of greens and you cook them longer so they become nice and crispy, and everything takes on this flavour of the chicken. And it's, again, it's that, it's the feeling, the arc of the seasons is something, I feel like I'll keep using the word soulful, but I think it is sort of what this food means to me. It is connecting with how you feel about yourself, how you feel about the way you want to eat, how you feel about the arc of the year. And this is such a simple idea. Roast a chicken, use the juices to cook your veg. Could not be simpler, but there's something very grounding about it.
Yeah, I call it gubbins. I need to find a new word, don't you?
No, I think gubbins will do as a treasure of a word. It's perfect.
No, you're absolutely right. That food movement illustrates exactly what the book is about. I mean, we're just about to emerge into spring and I do want asparagus now. I don't want those heavy Cavolo Neros anymore. I've been eating them all winter. I'm ready to breathe again and to have different colours on the plate.
But that's a danger, Gilly. And I'm sure you are holding your nerve and not going for the asparagus yet. I have confidence in you. But I think that what you're describing is what a lot of us feel. And that's why we chase on to the next thing too early. And that creates a problem because the pressure put on the farmers and therefore the land to get those new season things to us as quickly as possible is part of the problem. And hopefully I can be part of a solution of finding more ways that you can keep on enjoying your parsnips and your greens and maybe even your sprouts and things, so you can just stave off the yearning for asparagus, even by a couple of weeks, because those things can make all the difference for the farmers who are under such pressure to get stuff out.
Yes, and it really does matter that if you can get to the market. I mean, we've got an award-winning farmers market in Lewes, but we've also got the market, you know, with your Barrow Boys and the vegetables that they have are seasonal and they are absolutely fantastic. And I just think that if we had more markets around, you know, people would see the food that is available for now. I love the food memories. And I think that, you know, linking that to going to the market, you know, if you're a kid going down to the market with your mum or dad and you see all these wonderful colours and vegetables around at different times of the season, they create food memories. And your second food moment is the new potato salad. And I love this because I realised I hadn't really seen much of you. Here we see your mum in, you know, spaghetti straps and sandals, you know, washing the new potatoes, and you and your sisters. And that's a lovely thing. I'm really glad you put that in you. It feels much more Angela voice. But tell me about that memory.
That's really lovely, Jude, if you pick up on that, because if this is by far my most personal book, which I guess is no surprise, given the first one was about vinegar and the second one was a, you know, collaboration with Borough Market. So, but I was surprised by how personal I got with it, I suppose, and that when I was thinking about, okay, so I'm going to write about pumpkins, each one of the produce features begins with, you know, a page or whatever about a story, and a lot of them became my story and how I connect with those vegetables and fruits, which took me by surprise. But then I decided to really kind of embrace that and roll with it and you know, enjoy those kind of personal connections. And a lot of it is memory and how connecting food and memory are. And then the next stage of that is how grounded those food memories are in their seasons. So the one that you just mentioned is absolutely right. I will never not be washing new potatoes and think about being outside the house on a hot day with my mum's freshly painted toenails drying in the sun, the very particular yellow enamel bowl that she would only use for washing new potatoes. And I will never not think of that. My mum's not around, and it's a gorgeous connecting memory. And maybe it's why I love new potatoes so much, because every time I do it, I kind of have that moment of feeling close to her again. And it's not just, you know, new potatoes at any time of year, it's new potatoes on that kind of gorgeous summer's day. And so I decided to kind of really lean into the new potato theme and make it one of my kind of guides. So through the book, you'll have seen there are things that aren't really recipes, they're sort of I suppose I have to call them guides, use the word again, of how to do mashed potato, how to do roast potato, how to do winter broths. And it's easy to think, yeah, all right, Angela, like, we actually do know how to do roast potatoes, like, we've got this. But what I'm trying to do is show, again, it's that comprehensive, you know, rigorous thing, I suppose, of trying to show the different permutations of and how you can do the best version of those things, and then maybe think about amping them up in different ways. So for the new potatoes, it's about how to cook them in a way that really maximizes their gorgeous flavor and texture. When you get those very first nuggets of new potatoes, you know, you really want to protect their flavor and texture and not just boil it away. And then think about how you can get the flavors in there early while they're still warm and they're really ready to absorb all the lovely flavor. So the new potato salads was a lovely one to write and think of different ways of, it's not just one recipe for a new potato salad. It's a way of making new potato salads that we'll see right through the spring and the summer, with different ways of reinventing them. Keep saying the same thing, you know, helping yourself stay inspired by that produce right through its seasons by thinking, oh yeah, I could do that flavour partner, or I could think about you doing them in that way. And it's coming up with little ideas that just nudge people along.
Yeah. Missing it when it's gone is another theme. I love this. I mean, this is probably the essence of thinking about cooking with the seasons. We have lost the idea of missing it when it's gone. You know, you open the book with, you talk about how society feels it's earned the right to eat what and when it likes. That is crushing. You know, it's a food system that has absolutely numbed us to why we eat what we eat and the role of food in our lives, you know, right the way through to food justice and climate change. Mackerel you use as an example in your third food moment, as an example of something that you love to miss it when it's gone. You only eat it at a certain time. Yeah. Why mackerel?
Why mackerel? For the reasons you've just said, of it's only really around at a certain point. And so not only do I want to really enjoy it when it's around, I don't want to find a way to have it in my kitchen when it's not around, because that doesn't feel right. I think, yeah, we are all familiar with the excitement that comes with the first asparagus, the first strawberries, the first peaches, the first pumpkins. And the looking forward is something which is really easy to kind of get your head around. But tedium, loss, boredom, they're all things which are kind of important bits of life too. And therefore, I think they're also really important bits of the way we feed ourselves. And I kind of like my last spears of asparagus when I'm dipping them in butter and I know that's it. I know that's it for another 10 months. That feels okay, because that, you know, as I say, that's sort of, you know, that arc of it, the arc of the seasons is the arc of life, which all sounds very, you know, deep and intense. And so I'll come back to mackerel, which is, you know, it only flows around our waters at certain times of year. So, you know, from late spring through the summer into early autumn is when, you know, mackerel is in our waters. We can get it other times of year, but it's not going to be, you know, coming from our local British waters. And I think people are getting increasingly aware about the problems of salmon production and steering away from salmon. And again, I talk about it in the book, about the problems there are in salmon farming. And so I steer away from salmon in a way that a lot of people increasingly are. So I get my oily fish hit with mackerel, and I look forward to it when it comes, and it's probably, you know, certainly actually the fish that I cook the most right through the summer. And I, you know, try and do it simply. There's a recipe in the book for just, you know, pan frying it and sitting it on top of some raw samphire and some cucumber ribbons, and then you cook some tomatoes in with the juices of the mackerel. And again, it's all about building these layers of flavour with each other and letting the flavours of the season carry each other along. It's very much my approach to it. And so I would really urge people to, you know, especially in summer, part the salmon and really, you know, really go for the mackerel, because it's so delicious as well and so cheap. I think that's the other thing about mackerel, it is pretty cheap, certainly compared to salmon. I keep putting the two together, but I think they are kind of connected often in the way that we eat them and cook them. And so in season, this is another aspect of seasonality generally, that often things when they're in season are going to be cheaper.
Yeah, and get them from the fishmonger if you can.
Yes, indeed.
Your final food moment is, it's about the flavour partners that are really kind of what this book is about. It's about extending our repertoire and making us think about vegetables and how to cook them. I love the bit about the charred stalks, pairing them through the different seasons, because, of course, chard changes through the seasons, which is why I love it.
But you grow it, don't you?
I do grow it, and it grows very well. I mean, I'm not a great grower, and we were working on it yesterday, and there's a sense of failure because I'm looking at the rabbits watching me, watching them, and we just know that they're going to get it all. But somehow they don't like chard.
Well, I think before we go too much further, I'd better probably sort of out myself as having kind of written quite a lot of my stuff at your place.
Yes, you did.
Which has been, you know, gorgeous, gorgeous place and gorgeous creative space. But I do remember one morning when I was sitting outside the fabulous studio you have, you were kind of raging about how the rabbits or the deer had like got to your stuff. You were so cross about it.
Well, what can I do? I mean, you know, I'm not going to fence the whole place off. They have to. So we have a little bit for them, a bit for them. But I did build a polytunnel yesterday.
Oh, very good.
But chard stalks with potato and celeriac, as an example of seasonal buddies, as you call them. I love that. And your final food moment is about blood oranges and the first of spring's produce. Tell us about that flavour partnering.
Yeah. So every profile, there are 50 vegetables and fruits through the book, through the seasons. And each of them comes with, as I already mentioned, a sort of little story about them. And then there's ways to shop, ways to store, different ways to use that, cooking, not cooking, all kinds of stuff. And then the flavour partners, as you exactly say. And I think the flavour partners are one of the absolutely fundamental things in being inspired to find different ways to put things together. And one of the things that I feel most strongly in terms of the flavour partners is thinking about the ebb and flow of the seasons. And there aren't harsh cutoffs. You don't wake up one day and go, right, suddenly it's summer and I'm not going to even think about spring. That's not how it happens. There's a transition. And I think it's really gorgeous to embrace that transition of flavour in the food. And so pretty much every day at the moment, we're talking first week in March, pretty much every day for the last week or so, and probably for a little while yet, I am putting together the very first of the spring's purple sprouting broccoli with the very last of winter's blood oranges. And that feels very now in terms of where we are in terms of seasons. But, oh my goodness, it tastes good. And, you know, Mother Nature is very, very, very clever at putting the flavours together and putting things together that go together. And that applies to the transitions as well. So the gorgeous kind of, you know, zesty, sweet, complicated flavour of the blood oranges just peps up. It's just what purple sprouting broccoli needs, especially if you've got, you know, some anchovy or something in there too. It just really lifts it and gives it a whole other dimension. And it is as simple as roasting it or whatever and then just giving a squeeze over. Could not be more simple, but it's just getting those ideas in your head and having them become almost second nature.
I was talking to Anna Jones, whose episode goes out the week after you, and when I was talking to her, we'd just had a Yemeni supper club the night before. Two Yemeni refugees were showing us their food culture and their country and their whole sense of who they were through their food. And the food was traditional Yemeni food. Wasn't fancy flavours, wasn't any flavour partnering that they would do. They wouldn't use that kind of vocabulary. And Anna has created 124 brand new recipes. And I asked her, if we've got too much going on in our food culture in Britain compared with something like the Yemenis, who absolutely know everybody would know how to cook what those women cooked that night. Who are we as cooks in Britain?
It's so complicated that I'm dying to hear Anna's answer. I think that the sheer volume of food messaging can be quite overwhelming, and it can be quite daunting, I think. And a little bit of what set me on the track of writing seasoning was wanting to, yeah, you can't put everything in one place, but I did want to kind of corral quite a lot of the ideas, the inspiration that are around. You'll see at the back, there's a fairly extensive bibliography of work that has inspired what's happening in seasoning. And I wanted to try and kind of pull it all together. So there's sort of one place where people, or I anyway, one place where you can go to kind of find some ideas, because there is a lot out there. It's not only a lot of messaging, but obviously there's a lot of ways of the messaging reaching people. So I think it can be daunting, but I think that it can also be very inspiring. There are people out there who are trying to clarify and help people kind of use those things in their everyday life, because that's the thing. Stories are gorgeous. Having beautiful books is gorgeous to look at. And there's something very importantly aspirational about food and food writing and cookbooks and TV shows and all the rest of it. But if part of your focus is simply about wanting to help people feed themselves and feed their family, then I think then has to be a certain simplicity to it as well. I feel that's what Anna does brilliantly. And it's something which I felt very part of the inspiration behind what I was trying to do with seasoning.
You know, we were at the Delicious Party last week, Karen Barnes, who was the editor of Delicious until last week for 14 years. And I was just sort of looking around the room, and everybody was there who's been on Cooking the Books, but who has really kind of, you know, created this very deep and delicious food culture. And I was thinking that, you know, Karen started her editorship before Instagram and has driven a lot of the people in the room towards writing what they really want to say and taken it seriously. And it was a really interesting evening. You know, there are a group of food writers now who do take food seriously. And it's, again, it's not a finger wagging way. It is a way of bringing those stories from the producers to our plates to talk about why. And I wondered what Jane Grigson would say about this coterie of food writers. I'm thinking of Claire Finney, who was there, Georgie Hayden, who brings all that lovely identity to our food plates, Andy Oliver, who does the same, but with such pizzazz and character. Who else was there? Lerato, you know, brings Africana to us. So we're interested in flavour. And Felicity Cloak, of course, you know, who actually takes a snapshot in her hilarious books about Britain. I think that, you know, that giving a snapshot of now is a really important part of helping us to engage with the food under our nose. And that is very much what your book is all about. There's a lot of people taking food very seriously, and it's so beyond the Instagram. What do you think Jane Grigson would have said as holder of the award?
I think she'd wish she was around now, to be honest. And I think she would still fit in. I think that's the joy of Jane Grigson's work, the longevity of it. I'd like to think she'd be proud of the generation of food writers that is around at the moment, but also I think her work would stand up tall still within that, as does George's, as does Lerato's, as does Claire's. Let's throw Jeremy Lee in there as the token bloke for a generation of food writers who
Gil
are
Mellor's
hopefully
my man.
yeah Gil, of course, yes, and there are loads of them. I mean, only teasing, but I think that, you know, there is a generation of food writers who are really, you know, getting their messages out there. They're very, very, very different. You know, it's one of the things I find so joyous about working in this industry is that people are very supportive and very collaborative, because broadly speaking, we're all doing something a little bit different. And so there is space to be made for new voices to come through and to be celebrated. And I think that is tremendous. And that is something which I think Jane Grigson would hugely value, because she had that as well. She was brought along by Elizabeth David, really, and given so much opportunity. And I like to think that we are a generation of food writers who are still giving opportunity. There's much more, we all know there's much more to be done to widen the voices who are coming through. You know, I I think the class is a big one about, you know, we don't have, you know, enough depth of voices in that way kind of coming through. I know I sound like I'm kind of like middling than middle class, as you were just saying, but, you know, I'm from Lancashire and I don't, you know, we don't have enough Lancastrian voices, you know, I would say come enough northern voices coming through. So there's more to be done, but I think that we are supportive and collaborative and making space for each other in a way that has come, I think, from Jane Grigson.
Thanks for listening. Do head to Extra Bites on my Substack to get a taste of some of Angela's flavour pairing recipes from seasoning. I'll see you next week.